Good morning, everyone. I am back after a long exodus, you might say, from preaching. My last opportunity was way back on March 22nd when I did our first videotaped sermon. Those were the days when the virus was young and our government wasn't taking it seriously. So much has changed. So much hasn't. But here I am, preaching into the camera again. Certainly better than nothing, but I'm also very aware of my inability to really see anybody right now or get the feedback of an occasional nod or smile or even a snore. If a preacher preaches in a forest, does anybody say amen? Speaking of forests, Bible study sermons, which is what you're going to get from me today. Bible study sermons are kind of like guided hikes through the woods. And as your guide today, it's incumbent on me to lead you down into the weeds a bit, pointing out the fauna and the factoids you may have not seen before. But our trail will also wind upwards so that we might see the big picture as well. Snacks in the form of periodic quips and clever analogies will be provided. But I take no responsibility for high altitude sickness or blowing your mind. I mean, we're entering the extraordinary book of Exodus. It's no walk in the park. In fact, I'm just advised that my video has been launched and I'm trying to see if that is my fault or. And now I'm back. You see my face again. I don't know if that's good news or bad news. But where was I? I was saying that the story of the Hebrews' liberation from slavery is in fact the most important story in the Old Testament. Sure, the seven-day creation story and the great flood myth in Genesis are pretty important too, but none, I dare say, are as formative, as revolutionary, and as inspirational as the first half of Exodus. This is why it's been so often animated and painted, sculpted, dramatized, and preached and preached and preached. The story is central to the Jewish understanding of God. It's been a pivotal story in the Black Christian church. It is the foundation for much of liberation theology, and it's key for anyone who wants to understand Jesus, the new Moses. Exodus is the book where God gets political, and that's why we've chosen to read it now as we focus on the intersection of faith and politics, and as we try to make sense of how to live as God's people in this politically tumultuous hour. The context of the story is empire and oppression, and it concerns a process of social transformation wrought by a liberating God. I'd say that still sounds quite relevant for our times. As I've suggested, this story is perhaps the pivotal myth of our faith. And by myth, I don't mean something that never happened. Rather, I mean something that happens over and over again. I'll trust you'll see that by the end of our hike. But let's first look at what is particularly noteworthy in our portion of text. Chapters 2-4. So to reset the scene from last week, we were introduced to Pharaoh, the anxious, narcissistic, brutal king of Egypt who has enslaved the Hebrew people, and Moses, who by birth is part of God's chosen people. But having been raised in Pharaoh's court, he's also a privileged child of the empire. At this point in the story, one wonders, where do his allegiances lie? When push comes to shove, whose side is he on? I suppose you could ask the same of us, or any Christian or Jew living in the empire. Early in today's text, we read that one day after Moses had grown up, he noticed the suffering of his brothers. That's right, he both notices the suffering around him, and he identifies the victims as his siblings. That's significant. Once you see the afflicted as your kin, your welcome into the polite company of good Egyptians can start to get tenuous. When Moses sees a Hebrew, a brother, being beaten, he responds violently. He kills the Egyptian attacker and buries him in the sand. Over the centuries, many have debated whether this killing was morally justified. But what seems fairly clear in the story is that it didn't particularly threaten Pharaoh's hold on power. It just made Moses a marked man. So Moses flees far away to Midian, where he can live in obscurity. He starts his new life beyond the reach of the empire and its everyday brutality. And this raises an important question. What is there for a single guy new in town to do in Midian? Well, go hang out at the well, of course. Every biblical scholar knows that's the best place to meet women. That's where Abraham's servant met his wife, Rebecca. It's where Jacob met Rachel. And true to form, that's where Moses finds his bride as well. Interestingly, Moses' future wife and her sisters first identify Moses as an Egyptian. It seems he must be wearing the marks of his royal station. His identity is not yet cast. Moses marries and settles down, starts a family, and finds his place in the family business, sheep herding. If we know the Bible well enough to know that women are at the wells, we should also have our curiosity piqued at the fact that Moses is now a shepherd. Theologically, that can be a pretty auspicious gig. Abraham was a shepherd, David was a shepherd, Jesus is the good shepherd. It makes us wonder, is Moses apprenticing for a bigger assignment? And it's at this point in the story that the scene changes dramatically, but only momentarily. In the previous paragraph of Exodus, we were on the mountain with Moses and his sheep, but now we are transported back to the heart of Imperial Egypt and the slaves and slaveholders. So far, Pharaoh has dominated this narrative landscape, but now we get a glimpse of another character, one we haven't heard much about so far. It is Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews. And we learn that Yahweh has heard the cries of the slaves and takes notice. The scene is short, but it makes this critical theological point. The voice of grief is what mobilizes Yahweh to act in saving ways. It is the expression of pain and rage from the oppressed, which becomes the catalyst for the entire story to come. The scene quickly ends and we're back on the mountain with Moses and his sheep. But our appetite is now whetted for drama and we needn't wait long. Moses' attention is quickly grabbed by something stranger than a purple striped sheep. He notices a bush on fire and it's not being consumed. Now we could get bogged down trying to explain such a fantastic occurrence. But that is a path best not taken today. Rather, as Aviva Zornberg, a Jewish Torah scholar, says, we could think of this burning bush episode as a dramatic way of saying that Moses notices an anomaly in the world and searches for meaning in it. In doing so, he has a stunning encounter with God, who in the Bible is often identified with fire. It's a fitting metaphor because fire, like God, is a force human beings are both awed by and afraid of. The appearance of God in the burning bush initiates a dialogue between Moses and God. God begins by reiterating what the text has already told us, but with some added twists. God introduces God's self as the God of Israel, who has heard their cries, but also knows their suffering. The Hebrew verb here, yada, denotes an intimacy that comes from shared experience. God knows this suffering as God's own. Further, God says, I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians. God not only hears and knows the suffering of God's oppressed people, but God comes down into human history. God gets mobilized for action. Sounds awesome, right? But then we get the most stunning news yet. God says, I will send you, Moses, to Pharaoh to bring my people out of Egypt. This is no doubt where Moses wets his pants, metaphorically speaking. I mean, who in their right mind would not be incredulous, intimidated, scared silly, or at the very least dismissive of such an outlandish announcement? For what has been revealed in one brief utterance is, says Walter Brueggemann, that the grand intention of God has become a specific human responsibility, human obligation, and human vocation. God and human beings, heaven and earth, are all connected in the great and dangerous strategy of liberation. So it's no surprise that Moses spouts off with an endless list of objections, including, hey, this is a pretty bad plan, God. I'm a nobody. I'm not a good speaker. Nobody will believe me. And I don't even know what your real name is, for God's sake. You want me to tell them a fiery shrub sent me? Come on now. The exchange they have about God's name, where God tells Moses, tell them I am what I am, or I will be what I will be, may be the verse that has gotten more scholarly attention than any other in the Bible. It has birthed thousands of PhDs, which is to say, nobody really understands it. The best I can say is that God is being evasive here. God is refusing to give people handles to control, contain, or fetishize God. And if you want to know more about this passage, well, find another guide. But what we see here in Moses' many objections is a resistance to God's plan for redemption. And there's nothing unique to Moses about that. Look around. Such resistance continues today. We see it among those who oppress and do not fear God. And we see it just as strongly among God's own people. People who, like Moses at this stage in his journey, want to opt out of God's liberating movement. Well, we're nearing the top of our hike now, starting to see some of that big picture, the mythic element of this story, which comes around again and again in human history. It's most visible when one sees this as a story about living in a world of competing gods who seek our undivided allegiance. These gods have different visions of how society is to be structured, how we're to live together. That is to say, they have very different political perspectives. One god, call him Pharaoh or God of Rome or God of the Empire, is steeped in a vision of domination and anxious scarcity, which requires the accumulation of ever more wealth, might, and control. It runs on a predatory economy of winners and losers, where the winners win on the backs of the exploited. Those who accept this vision, who live under this God, always end up legitimizing violence in order to maintain their place in the world. And yet they find that the peace and security they seek is so often just out of reach. But there is an alternative. Yahweh is the life-giving, life-affirming force that wells up from the margins, the God of abundance, who offers rest and freedom for those who despair, who blesses the poor, the meek, those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. It's a radical departure from the way of Pharaoh. So Exodus is a story of contrasting visions, but it's also a liturgy reminding us what it takes to leave the clutches of one God and to recognize Yahweh as the true God of heaven and earth. It's a liturgy we must come back to time and time again. If you look ahead to chapter 16, you'll find that the very Israelites who were celebrating their freedom under Yahweh a few chapters earlier are now tired and they want to go back to Egypt. Pharaoh does have such an alluring story. We are all tempted to imagine that the centers of power, wealth, and wisdom will make us happier and safer, and we're repeatedly disappointed. In the letter to the Romans, the Apostle Paul condenses the liturgy to this. Do not be conformed to the world, he says, but be transformed so that you may discern the will of God to overcome evil with good. Well, how shall we, sisters and brothers, not be conformed, but overcome evil and do justice? Last week, I spoke to the MYF about faith and politics and tried my hand at answering that question. I said there are three things that allow evil or injustice to thrive. One is complacency. We don't pay attention. We're distracted, indifferent, or self-absorbed. We don't notice the burning bushes around us. We don't hear or give much mind to the cries of the oppressed. Second is silence. Maybe we hear, but we don't speak up. We observe, but don't act. We say like Moses did, I'm not good at this. I don't speak well. Or a literal translation of that is that Moses says he has a heavy mouth. Interestingly, the adjective heavy is the same one used to describe Pharaoh's heart. It's heavy, somehow resistant, impervious. We hear, but we don't respond. So you got complacency, silence, and the third is lack of imagination. We have no compelling vision. We see no viable alternatives. We lose hope that anything can really substantively change. Those three are how injustice thrives. So to do justice, I suggested, is to do the opposite of those three. Rather than complacency, pay attention. Look beyond yourself and your distractions. Put yourself in places you will see and hear what your life is structured to have you not see and hear. Second, rather than silence, speak up, ask questions, act in ways you can, join with others who are speaking out, offer hospitality to strangers, respond with compassion to the despised. And third, rather than to have a lack of imagination, immerse yourself in an alternative way of seeing. One that blesses peacemakers, celebrates abundance, imagine swords turning to plowshares. Immersing yourself in an alternative way of seeing is the primary and most important mission of the church. It's the whole point of studying these sacred stories so that we nurture hope and faith in the God who leads us out of the land of Pharaoh. In a few short weeks, once the election is over, we'll wake up in a nation badly broken. And while the results will make a substantial difference, they won't save us from potentially breaking even further. Either way, we will need communities of Shifras, Puas, and Moseses, of William Barbers, Tracy Blackmans, and Patrice Cullors, those who serve the God of the Bible and not the God of empire. And so may we, like Shipra, Pua, and Moses, become resistant to the paralysis of fear. May we, like Moses, reject the privileges doled out by the empire. And may we, like Shipra, Pua, and Moses, be among those who defend the oppressed. God, in your mercy, may it be so. Amen.